From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are in Washington, D.C. today ahead of tomorrow's inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States. And Robin, all over town, there are people who have come here for tomorrow's events, hundreds of thousands expected to turn out.
And yes, you could pick them out at Reagan National Airport last night, especially the women just in from Texas. They had on these red, white, and blue shirts. I just wondered, are you here for the inauguration?
We are here for the inauguration.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have the Texas flag shirts on.
So they're blue, red
with
white, and blue,
the big star. Yeah. This is actually because we were both national delegates.
I couldn't help but notice your Make America Great Again hat. What are you here for?
I'm here for the inauguration, parade, concert, all the balls. It's going to be a great time.
Where'd you come from?
Dallas, Texas.
And what's your hope for the days ahead?
Hope that it's a peaceful transition and that everyone can celebrate collectively.
And what are you looking forward to on Friday?
President Trump getting inaugurated.
Yeah. What does it mean to you?
It's everything. I think Trump's almost a modern-day George Washington.
Modern-day George Washington. Sounds of Americans arriving in D.C. for tomorrow's inauguration. And someone who's seen this incoming every 4 years is Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Great to be with you, Robin.
With you. And change in the air and change on the air. We've been watching today Vice President-elect Mike Pence, head of the transition team, spoke about Donald Trump's cabinet picks. Let's listen.
I'm proud to say to be at a place where we've named our entire cabinet before we reach that historic day tomorrow.
Okay. Your thoughts on the choice of words there, Ron Elving?
That's a good thing, to have chosen all of your cabinet by the first day of the administration. Of course, they've not been confirmed, and perhaps two of them will be confirmed tomorrow, General Mattis and General Kelly for Secretary of Defense and Secretary of Homeland Security. They have cleared their committees, and they're ready for Senate approval tomorrow. The rest of the cabinet is still in the process. The last one was just named last night. That's former Governor of Georgia, Sonny Perdue, who will be the new Agriculture Secretary. So that was the last name to be named. But, of course, the confirmation process is still very much in process.
Well, and your thoughts on that? Because, Vice President-elect Pence was saying they've named, as if it's done, but it's not done.
No, it's not done. This is not to say that any of the nominees may fail to be confirmed at some point or another, although there are some question marks over a couple of them. But the process is a little bit slowed down. It's not nearly as fast as it was 9 years ago or 8 years ago in 2009. And the Republicans say that's because the Democrats are dragging their feet. The Democrats say it's because the Republicans haven't cleared the Office of Governmental Ethics yet. They haven't turned in their paperwork or it hasn't been vetted as yet. And we do have some extraordinarily wealthy people who have a lot of paperwork to clear.
Well, incoming White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer also gave a briefing today, and he called out Democrats on just that, what you were saying. Let's listen.
The Democratic leadership is not working with us to ensure a continuity of government. This was not the precedent that was set by Senate Republicans when they worked with the Obama administration in 2008.
And what else are we hearing about their frustration?
They would, of course, like to have the confirmation process already be finished, but in a number of cases, the individuals who were chosen by the Trump transition team had not been vetted prior to the election because, well, they may not have expected at the time to be asking people to serve in the cabinet. So they didn't really have a pre-selected list to already be vetted. And so it took quite a bit of time. Even though they were named quickly, it took quite a bit of time to do the original vetting, get the paperwork together to go to the Office of Governmental Ethics, which is supposed to have signed off before the confirmation hearings take place in the committees of the Senate. Mm. And that hasn't taken place even yet for many of these nominees.
Well, just one note from the hearings today. Rick Perry, former Texas governor, former presidential candidate, Donald Trump's pick to head the Department of Energy, which, of course, he famously once said when he remembered the name of it that he wanted to get rid of. His hearing started today. Your thoughts?
He said this at his hearing this morning. My past statements made over 5 years ago about abolishing the Department of Energy do not reflect my current thinking, which I think would be a great relief to many people in that department. In fact, he said, after being briefed on so many of the vital functions of the Department of Energy, I regret recommending its elimination.
Because now I might have a job heading it. So, Ron Elving, you've seen many of these, as we said, comings and goings. Your thoughts on this particular day before inauguration, how it feels to you?
Well, it's great in Washington right now because it's warm. It's not freezing like it was 8 years ago, down around zero. And we have unusually warm weather, unseasonably warm weather, but we're worried about it raining tomorrow and raining on the parade, quite literally. But there's quite a mix of emotions here. This city and the immediate region around it did not vote for Donald Trump, but the people who are coming here are ecstatic, as we just heard from the people at the airport. They're enormously excited about it, much like people were 8 years ago for Barack Obama.
It's the mark of America, the peaceful transition of power, and we will witness it. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Donald Trump's pick for Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is on Capitol Hill today for confirmation hearings. He worked at Goldman Sachs for 17 years, but he's come under criticism for what happened at IndyMac, a bank he and other investors bought in 2009. That bank has been called a foreclosure machine. Here's Mnuchin today defending his record.
I want to correct the record about my involvement with IndyMac Bank. Since I was first nominated to serve as Treasury Secretary, I have been maligned as taking advantage of others' hardship in order to earn a buck. Nothing could be further than the truth.
Joining us now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's in New York. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
First of all, by the way, he just said further than the truth. I assume
yes.
He meant to say nothing could be further
right. I think
from
he had
truth.
Trouble hearing. I mean, I've been listening to this testimony all day, and it's not very contentious. He's good with this group. There are issues. But to say that nothing could be further than the truth, that he took over this bank and ran it to make a buck, I mean, I don't think it's disrespectful to say, actually, that's exactly why you bought the bank. So it's not coming across as all that sincere, the idea that there was something altruistic about him taking over a failing bank during the financial
crisis. Well, give
us
the background on this. Tell us about this criticism about IndyMac and Mnuchin's role.
Well, IndyMac was sort of central to a lot of the major foreclosures, a California bank. And they were really at the front end before a lot of the mainstream bigger banks got involved in foreclosures and the ball started rolling. IndyMac, some say, didn't make the best decisions about trying to keep some of the people in homes, but foreclosed much sooner than they probably should have. He was making the argument that they really tried hard to keep people in their homes and that he didn't do it to, you know, he didn't foreclose to make a profit. The fact is IndyMac was a bank in distress. He bought it. He became the chairman of it. And they oversaw tens of thousands of foreclosures.
He was also asked about something else by Democrat Ron Wyden of Oregon about Mnuchin's hedge fund and his use of the tax haven in Anguilla. Let's take a listen.
How many employees did you have in Anguilla?
We didn't have any employees in Anguilla.
Did you have an office there?
We did not have a office ourselves there.
So you just had a post office box?
Senator, let me explain
to you. It's just a yes or no answer.
Now, Mnuchin said he didn't break any rules, but did we get a sense on this issue of whether he would change the tax code or want to change the tax code to prevent companies from shielding profits in these tax havens?
He was asked that specifically by Ron Wyden. He was asked that specifically by Senator Debbie Stabenow from Michigan. And his response was, I would change the tax code to make it more efficient. It's not clear what that means. His implication was that companies do business in Anguilla and the Cayman Islands because it's more efficient than doing business in the United States. They keep a post office there. He did not say that he would actually close loopholes. He did say he wants to reform the IRS. That's the IRS itself, not the tax code. That's bipartisan. Everybody agrees the IRS is a bit of a mess and needs to be repaired. But he did not clarify where he would stand on businesses that possibly escape some regulation and or taxes by domiciling somewhere outside of the United States.
Well, and speaking of taxes, we've heard that one of the first things that Trump wants to do from an economic perspective is cut taxes, which he wants to do first, it sounds like, for corporations and then maybe later for individuals. Yep. What do we know about what he might do and who's likely to benefit?
Well, corporate tax cuts are easier, first of all. They're just not as political. There is anecdotal evidence that it is good for business. I say anecdotal because Canada cut corporate taxes by a lot, the way they were high, like the U.S.'s taxes were, and they made them a lot lower. And it didn't result in some remarkable growth, but Canada's not the United States. I will say this. This argument the Republicans make that American taxes are the highest in the world doesn't hold water because most American companies don't pay those taxes. So there is bipartisan agreement to cut corporate taxes, but there isn't bipartisan agreement on how you cut personal taxes or whether you cut personal taxes. you cut them on the wealthy, or do you cut them on the middle class? And so that's where we're waiting to see whether there's going to be greater clarity sometime in the next few days about what these tax cuts are going to look like.
And just briefly, I mean, there's a big debate about whether tax cuts for individuals work, whether they yeah. grow the economy or whether they just grow the deficit.
Right, or the wallets of the very wealthy. What we've right. found is that because of the way in which wealthy people can invest, when you cut taxes, it doesn't necessarily go directly into the economy. When you cut taxes on the poor, they're not flying overseas and going other places, so it does go into the economy. So that's a big discussion that's going to take place in the next little while. But it's not a given that trickle-down economics works when it comes to tax cuts.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks so much as
My
always.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Donald Trump will take the oath of office tomorrow to the cheers of many, but almost 60 Democratic lawmakers now will not be there, including Congressman Brendan Boyle, who represents part of Philadelphia. Let's start a look at the country's divide over Donald Trump with him. Congressman Boyle, you wrote you've actually been wrestling with going for the last 2 months. Why aren't you?
So in my specific case, I'm always of the opinion, and I wrote this, that the inauguration of a president should be a non-political day. It is because I believe that Donald Trump is so different and not in keeping with our small d democratic norms that I really had to wrestle with my conscience over the last 2 months whether I would feel good looking back decades from now about having been at his inauguration. And I came to the conclusion I simply couldn't.
Well, let's go further. You write, can I in good conscience celebrate that which I believe is a grave mistake? Do you know, I mean, how insulting that is to the Americans who voted for Donald Trump?
Well, and I'm sorry that it can come off that way, but I hope people recognize that for me, this is not a partisan issue. I would have attended the inaugurations of any previous Republican president. It is because of the dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of incidents in which Donald Trump has proved himself unworthy to be president, beginning with the fact that he was the lead birther, that for 5 years he even questioned whether the still sitting president of the United States was even American. The fact that he has talked about torture in a way that really just disregards our Constitution. The fact that he is such a threat when it comes to national security. And it is because of those grave misgivings I have that I came to the conclusion I just couldn't be part of the inauguration.
But you mentioned Donald Trump or himself being one of the leaders in the birther movement questioning Barack Obama's legitimacy. You know how Democrats felt at that time. And I asked your fellow Democrat Congressman Steve Cohen the same thing when he said he was not going. Don't you feel that you're now doing the same thing that Republicans did to Democrats in questioning? You're not questioning the lawfulness of Donald Trump, but you are questioning, you know, whether or not he's dangerous. And in so doing, you're doing the same thing that the Republicans did.
Well, there would be, of course, a certain degree of fairness in that. But I don't actually agree that I'm doing the same thing as Trump did to Barack Obama. I'm not questioning whether or not he's lawfully president. What I'm saying is to sit up mere yards by on the steps of the Capitol and watch him swear an oath to a constitution that he clearly doesn't believe in. The fact that he has talked openly and still to this day about doing things that are completely illegal, I just don't want to be a part of. And I'm going to fulfill my constitutional obligations. I'm under no constitutional obligation to attend the inauguration, and therefore I've decided not to.
And what action might Donald Trump take that you would praise?
Well, I'll say, and I've written this, that if he is willing to compromise with Democratic members when it comes to transportation and infrastructure, that would be a level of pragmatism that I would welcome. We've had a really 5 or 6 year period now of Tea Party absolutism where they equate any sort of compromise as surrender. Trump has talked openly about being willing to make deals and being flexible. If he follows through with what he said during the campaign that he wouldn't touch Social Security or Medicare, I would praise him on that. Again, people can have normal disagreements when it comes to matters of public policy. It's the areas in which Trump is so outside the Democratic norms that greatly concern me.
That's Congressman Brendan Boyle, the Democrat who represents Pennsylvania's 13th District, which includes parts of Philadelphia, who's sitting out the inauguration. Congressman Boyle, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And now let's bring in a Republican who is going to the inauguration, Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi. Senator, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be with you.
And what do you want to hear from Donald Trump in his speech tomorrow?
Well, I want to hear a unifying message, and I think we'll hear that. But I think we'll also hear that elections have consequences, that this particular person campaigned on changing the direction of the federal government and changing the direction of how business is done in our capital city, and I think he'll talk about that also.
What do you think it means, or why do you think that he is about to deliver his speech tomorrow and go into his inauguration with the lowest approval rating since they've been tracking these kinds of things?
I don't worry about that. I really think, you know, we've had presidents go in with very high approval ratings, and then you see by the midterm, for those midterm elections, the party of the president loses seats. So I think the more important thing is how he governs and how he's perceived to have kept his campaign promises and moved our economy and moved job creation and moved our standing in the world in a year or a year and a half. I'm more interested in that.
Well, why do you think he's got such a low approval rating before he's even taken office?
I think probably the contentiousness of the election, and you know, I love the press, love the First Amendment. Don't get me wrong, but I do think maybe he's been the subject of some pretty withering criticism in the mainstream media, and that never helps.
What about his tweets and his thin skin and even the comments recently disparaging the U.S. intelligence community? Do you think that those things – how did you feel about
all
that stuff?
I've got a lot of friends in the intelligence community. I think this is all going to be just fine. I think about the second day in office, he's going to understand that they're on his side and we're all on America's side. And I think he'll begin to repair whatever little damage might have been done there. So I think that's going to be – I think that's just going to be fine.
You think he should stop tweeting once he takes office?
Right. Moving on to the question about the tweets. You know, isn't it amazing? The first tweet I ever did was 8 years ago. I mean, two presidential terms ago, hardly anyone had heard of a tweet. And now the leader of the free world is routinely using them. I was one of those folks calling the campaign between the convention and the general election, suggesting to the president that he wasn't well served by continuing to do this. So what did I know? If I had my druthers, I would hope that he would not tweet about everything. But then again, this is a way he communicates with the average American, and it seems to have served him well. But particularly when it comes to things that really don't amount to policy, a movie star, an athlete, or something like that. If he asked my advice, I'd say I'd just leave those things alone. Not everything needs to be responded to when so many things are coming at you. But again, if he had taken my advice, he might not be about to take the oath of office as the 45th president of the United States. So who am I?
That's Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican of Mississippi. Senator, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
This Saturday night, the Reverend Dwight Walter of the somewhat progressive Congregation Church of Patchogue on New York's Long Island wants people from both sides of the Trump divide to gather for a post-inauguration healing. Now, we've spoken to Pastor Walter before. There was a violent event that convulsed his town, a murder outside his church. Pastor, remind us.
8 years ago, there was a hate crime murder of a 34-year-old undocumented Latino at the hands of seven teenagers from the local high school. All of the signs were there beforehand that we needed to do something peacefully, proactively, and nobody wanted to hear about it.
This was the brutal beating death of the Ecuadorian immigrant Marcelo Lucero. There was a trail of blood as he tried to escape these teens who beat him to death.
Yes, and by coincidence, we were having a peace party while this guy was being beaten and stabbed to death thought, you know what, I'm not going to take this laying down anymore. I'm tired of sitting around and choosing sides and being asked to choose sides. And now there's a lot at stake.
Well, and you've also had an encounter with Donald Trump. The last time we spoke, Donald Trump, the candidate, was planning an appearance at a Republican fundraiser just blocks from where Marcelo Lucero was beaten to death and blocks from your church, and you and others were calling on him to please, out of respect, not do it there. I mean, this was a huge outcry.
Yes, I went up against Donald Trump, and it was in the national news. I was on your show as well. But few people know that after I had the vigil at my church, I went directly with Secret Service, the clearance, etc., to where Trump was speaking as an invited guest of the Republican Party. That's very difficult work. Where that was what I really wanted, was to say we don't have to choose sides. We can learn from both sides.
Well, I know you have Republican leaders from your area coming to your healing ceremony on Saturday night.
And they know that they trust and they believe that they're not being rope-a-doped and set up for some contentious corner and now beat them down with our eloquence. How do you get people to listen to you and to talk to you honestly and openly if you're yelling at them? Let's get together in the name of peace.
Well, we wish you the best on Saturday. That's Reverend Dwight Walter of the Congregational Church of Patchogue on Long Island, who's also asking people to write letters to America on Facebook. We'll link you up at herenow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
The games that will decide who plays Super Bowl 51 on February 5th will be played this Sunday. The conference championships feature the Green Bay Packers and the Atlanta Falcons for the NFC title, followed by the Pittsburgh Steelers and the New England Patriots battling for the AFC crown. Mike Pesca is HereNow's sports analyst and host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So start with the NFC. The Packers won against the Dallas Cowboys last weekend in that last-second field goal. Great game. But can they take that momentum into the game against the Falcons?
Well, the momentum goes even further back than that. They won their last seven games in the regular season, which has only surprised a lot of people who didn't realize that Aaron Rodgers is a magician who doesn't operate according to the laws of physics. And he's such a dynamic, amazing player. People don't realize that the Green Bay quarterback, or maybe they do, that his receiving core is decimated and he can just find anyone and create opportunities for himself. He's so entertaining. That said, beyond Aaron Rodgers, and especially on the defense, the Packers are deficient, and Atlanta has a great offense themselves, and their defense has been improving.
Okay, so let's move on to the fact that it's being played in Atlanta. Home field advantage, you know, how important is that going to be? Because that's indoors.
Yes. Well, one of the big parts of home field advantage is that they don't have to go to Lambeau Field and play outdoors, though I checked the weather. It's going to be about 40 degrees in Green Bay, where the game won't be played. Indoors and nice temperature is better for Atlanta. And I think a lot of people are pointing to the fact that it's a dome and a fast surface, and Atlanta likes to play fast. However, they actually have more wins on the road than at home this year. So I don't think that's the major thing. Statistics show that referees give the home team a few more calls. I really think it'll be an extremely high-scoring game, but probably come down to the question of if Green Bay can possibly cover Atlanta's receiving core.
Well, by the way, I mean, I'm going backwards here, but do you think that last second field goal Packers-Cowboys game was one of the best football games ever played?
Maybe. It was the best in that round of the playoffs. I also like the fact that their field goal kicker, Mason Crosby, was 3 out of 2 on last-second field goal tries. Because remember, he actually converted one, and Dallas had called a timeout, so they made him kick it again, and he kicked it again. So he just kept kicking 50-yard field goals.
They almost killed him by congratulating him. Let's move on to the AFC Championship game. The Steelers and the Patriots, old rivals, meeting again. How do you see that?
I think that these all the quarterbacks are amazing in this round of the playoffs, but Tom Brady just might be the most amazing. They did not play great against Houston, and yet the game wasn't that much in doubt. A few other plays would have had Houston in the game. The Patriots are 4-1 hosting conference championship games at home. They have the advantage. The thing that the Steelers have going for them, aside from their quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, is they have the best running back in football, Le'Veon Bell, and he'll be a headache for the Patriots.
Okay. Well, but, you know, you forgot to mention the one thing that Tom Brady now has that I'm not sure the other players have. He has those pajamas that you can sleep in, apparently, and they will heal you or something. I mean, can I just ask, we only have a couple seconds here, but how much do people hate across the country, hate what a golden boy he is? A lot?
They probably do, but it's just jealousy. I just hope those pajamas aren't underinflated. That's all I have to throw out there.
Mike Pesca, your now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast at Gist at Slate.com. Big games this weekend. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today is the last full day of Barack Obama's presidency. For some, that's good news. Others wish he could hang around for another term. Obama himself said recently on David Axelrod's podcast he believes he could have won a third term.
I'm confident that if I had run again and articulated it, I think I could have mobilized a majority of the American people to rally behind it.
Of course, seeking a third term is not possible. The 22nd Amendment prohibits it. So why is that? Let's bring in Alan Lichtman, distinguished professor of history at American University. He's on Skype. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And remind us how we got here. What was the 22nd Amendment and why was it passed?
The 22nd Amendment was passed for a simple reason. After World War II, the Republicans took over the Congress in 1946, and they were quite chagrined that Franklin Roosevelt had not only broken but shattered the supposed George Washington two-term tradition and had been elected four times as president of the United States, shutting out the Republicans. And, of course, upon his death, Harry Truman, his vice president, took over. So in 1947, Congress passed the 22nd Amendment, limiting presidents to two terms with some restrictions with regard to how you exactly count two terms. It has to be at least 1.5 terms or more. They didn't apply it to Truman, but they applied it to all subsequent presidents, and it was ratified by 3/4 of the states in 1951 and has been part of our Constitution ever since.
Was there any pushback? Were there people at the time who said, no, we should allow presidents to serve more than two terms?
There, of course, was pushback at the time, and there has been pushback ever since. There have been repeated efforts, in fact, by members of Congress to introduce measures to repeal the 22nd Amendment, but they have gone absolutely nowhere. But at the time and up to the present, there were those who say, let the people decide. Don't bar a president from seeking a third term. It may be in the best interest of the country.
Well, and you mentioned the George Washington rule. George Washington made the decision on his own to only serve two terms. But why didn't it happen after that? How come no president went beyond two terms between that point and FDR?
Well, in the first place, George Washington kind of set the precedent for everything. And although he never explicitly said presidents should be limited to two terms, because George Washington stepped down when he certainly could have had a third term after two, this created kind of the informal Washington tradition that two terms should be enough for any American president. That didn't mean, though, that presidents didn't try for a third term. Ulysses S. Grant, who is not regarded today as a very good president, very good general, served two terms through 1877, and then sought a third term when he fought for the Republican nomination in 1880. Very narrowly lost out to James A. Garfield, who we know, of course, was narrowly elected president in 1880. Theodore Roosevelt, who served almost all of William McKinley's second term, as well as a term of his own, certainly could have been reelected for a third term in 1908. He decided he was going to go off and to Africa and hunt big game instead. But then he didn't like what his successor, William Howard Taft, was doing. And he tried to get a third term by running first for the Republican nomination unsuccessfully, and then as an independent Progressive Party candidate in 1912, but of course didn't win. And Woodrow Wilson, after serving two terms in 1920, very much wanted to run for a third term, but he had suffered a series of strokes, was probably too infirm to weather a presidential campaign, and was pretty unpopular in the aftermath of the war.
So what do you think, looking back on all of those instances and others, are the pluses and minuses? What are the good things and bad things about having term limits on the president?
Well, the good thing, of course, is we create change, and change is often needed, and change is often good, and we kind of prevent a president from gaining too much power. One of the big arguments at the Constitutional Convention for many terms was that if we had limited the president to just a certain number of terms, that he might act tyrannically. But others responded, well, you could establish virtually an aristocracy if you let the president have unlimited terms. That argument was rejected, but it is an argument that many have come to hold today.
We're talking about presidential term limits with Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University. And let's talk about what happened in New York City, because they have term limits on the mayoral position. And Michael Bloomberg, after serving two terms, decided he wanted to run for a third term, and he got them to change the rules for him, just a one-time thing, to run for a third term. And he ended up winning that third term. Could that happen in Washington? Could Congress pass a one-time exemption for a president to run for a third term?
Only if they wanted to get themselves into a lot of steaming, bubbling hot water. Look, the two-term limitation is not a statute. It is a constitutional provision. And I'm no lawyer, but as far as I know, you cannot, by passing a law, suspend a constitutional provision. No matter how much you loved the sitting president, no matter how much the members of Congress wanted that person to go on, I think they'd probably be slapped down by the Supreme Court if they tried to muck around with the Constitution.
Do you think that President Obama is right that he would have won a third term if he could have run for one?
Probably every president who served two terms believes they could have been elected to a third term. Maybe George W. Bush didn't because his approval ratings were down in the 20s. But I'm sure lots of presidents like, Woodrow Wilson, Ronald Reagan, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton believed they could. The truth is, we will never know. You can't unravel a single thread of history. Once you do that, the whole fabric becomes undone and you have to reweave it. So there is absolutely no way to know, to prove or disprove, whether Obama or any other two-term president could have won a third term. In some cases, it seems pretty clear given the political context. Certainly, as I said, Teddy Roosevelt could have won a third term. But in the modern era, when the parties are so closely divided, it's a free shot for Obama. No one can prove him wrong, although no one can prove him right either.
You have been proven right a number of times in predicting who the next president would be, including
right
in this election, where a lot of people thought that your forecast must be wrong. But in fact, you were right. Donald Trump won. Now that he is president-elect and is about to be president of the United States, what are you anticipating about what's going to happen in the Trump presidency?
Well, at the same time I issued my prediction of a Trump victory, I issued a second prediction that's gotten almost as much attention. In fact, the story about it in The Fix in The Washington Post was the most viewed story of the year, and that was that Donald Trump would face impeachment at some time during his first term. Now, that was not a scientific prediction like the prediction of a Trump win. It came out of my gut, but I had some good reasons for it. First of all, Trump has a tradition, a history of flouting the law. He's been accused of sexual assault and sexual harassment by a dozen women. He has enormous conflicts of interest. He certainly has a history during the campaign and before of playing fast and loose with the truth. Remember, it was perjury that sunk Bill Clinton and got him impeached. In addition, why would a Republican Congress impeach a Republican president? That kind of thing just doesn't happen. Well, Donald Trump is not your typical Republican. He has no history of service or loyalty to the party. And Republicans love order and predictability. And Donald Trump is an unpredictable loose cannon. The Republicans would much prefer to have the predictable, down-the-line, standard-issue, Christian conservative Mike Pence.
Well, we will see if your prediction comes true. But first, we'll let him get inaugurated. Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
My great pleasure. Take care.
From Washington, D.C. today, ahead of tomorrow's inauguration of Donald Trump, there's a lot to do in town. Private Tours of Washington has come up with a new inside tour of Trump's D.C. For up to $685, you can see where Marla Maples threw her engagement ring and high heels at Trump while screaming, "I will never marry you." Of course, she did. But many we're meeting are coming here with more serious concerns. Here's Sylvia Guzman in from the Dallas area.
Exhilarated. I mean, we're really thankful to have someone who will put, especially because in Texas we just lost another police officer near where we're from, and so we're really excited to have someone who has the respect of our police officers front and center and our military.
And we caught up with Andrew Brenner, a state rep from Ohio, checking into his hotel.
I think that what Trump's going to bring is, I think he's going to bring something back to the middle class that they haven't seen probably in 30 or 40 years, which are good paying jobs. And I think that's something that's been missing in the United States economy, especially back in Ohio where I'm from.
We also met Trump supporters hoping he'll follow through on his promises about undocumented immigrants, many of whom are drawing up emergency plans if their families are deported. Liz Jones from Here and Now contributor KUOW in Seattle visited one family wondering whether so-called sanctuary policies offer any real protection.
We picked the school as our meeting place. Victor has worked as a custodian at this junior high for several years. It's in a suburb of Seattle, near his home. He also runs a landscaping business on the side. He rolls a garbage tub down the hallway toward his office. Victor's also not his real name. We're using a fake name because he's undocumented. Victor and his wife came here from Colombia about 12 years ago. They have two girls in college and one more in grade school. Only the youngest was born here. As we walk outside, Victor says lately he loses a lot of sleep thinking about the future. This is one of the biggest fears, he says. I don't want a plan B where the family returns to Colombia. Victor and his family left Colombia because of violence. And in the U.S., they basically turned themselves in to immigration. They asked for asylum. It was denied. For now, their case is still open. That's why Victor's allowed a work permit. But they could be deported at any time. Over the years, the family has prepared for various scenarios. It's good to have a plan, Victor says. We keep it within our family. But it's hard to have something concrete because we don't know what the situation will be. For example, his oldest daughter is 22 now. Could she take charge of the younger girls if the parents had to leave? The families turned to a close friend who's a U.S. citizen. The friend agreed to look after the girls and the family home in case the parents can't. Immigration lawyers recommend a more binding agreement, a power of attorney. So far, Victor's held off, but he's got a trusted attorney to call if the time comes. It's another key piece of their emergency plan. Letting out a big sigh, he says this is the main topic at home right now. It's stressful. The happiness is not there like before, he says. The main theme is what's going to happen. Are they going to let us stay? Are they going to make us leave? Seattle is one of many cities that's doubled down on sanctuary policies for undocumented immigrants. This means police and city staff don't get involved in immigration enforcement. They leave that to the feds. Ku Vu heads Seattle's Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. She says the policies aim to create a welcoming city where all people can live without fear.
If you were to step outside Seattle city boundaries, an officer may ask about your immigration status. We don't here in Seattle, for example. In another municipality, you may or may not be eligible for services such as homelessness shelters. and food programs. Here in Seattle, you are, because we serve everybody.
Seattle officials are also looking into a legal defense fund to help immigrants who are at risk of deportation. Similar programs already exist in L.A., Chicago, and other cities.
I mean, it's absolutely absurd.
That's Craig Keller. He heads a group called Respect Washington. The group is pushing a citizens' initiative to block Seattle sanctuary policies. As a taxpayer, Keller opposes any city funds directed toward undocumented immigrants, and he's eager to see Donald Trump follow through on one of his campaign promises to withhold federal funds from sanctuary cities.
So I'm welcoming this new examination by the federal administration about what federal dollars are coming to the city. Where is that money going to, and how is it being wasted?
This is a recording from when I first met Victor and his family about 4 years ago. It's a big 15th birthday party called the Quinceañera for Victor's daughter. They're dancing a father-daughter waltz together, all smiles. I was writing a story about the family's legal situation, and they invited me into their home and lives to talk about it. This time is different. Only Victor wanted to talk. He says the rest of his family, his wife and daughters, are too stressed and disillusioned. This family's been in the eye of immigration for a long time, and Victor has a little advice for others who may find themselves here too.
El único consejo que le puedo dar a cualquier
He says, the only advice I can give any family is to stay calm, try to stay happy, keep working, and continue on as honest people in this country. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Jones in Seattle.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.